2. 7 minutes of the game left. 0-0. And Lucas took a massive swipe at the ball with his wrong foot, missed it completely, and whacked the opposing winger in the stomach, right in the middle of the area, right in front of the referee. The other kid went down, not because he was looking for a penalty, but because all the air and maybe even a couple of internal organs had been thumped out of him. Joseph was fond of Lucas. He wasn't much good at football, and he wasn't very bright, but Joseph had been coaching him for 3 years, and he'd never once missed training or a match. He was a good kid, despite his father, who was not a good or even reasonable man, and who, like his son, turned up to every game. Parental pride often rendered him temporarily blind, and when the referee pointed to the spot, there was a volley of abuse that wasn't shocking because Joseph had heard it all before. "Are you fucking kidding, ref?" This was delivered at such a volume that the referee, 50 yards away, turned round and stared at him. "Keep it down, John," said Joseph. "Were you watching?" "Yes, it was a nailed-on pen." The opposing winger was still lying on the ground, being comforted by the opposition coach. "He never touched him. He hasn't moved since he got kicked. He'll be right as rain in a moment, you watch. You're not even supposed to be standing here, mate." He wasn't. He was supposed to be with the other parents behind the goal. Only coaches and the substitutes were allowed on the touchline. The rules didn't apply to John, though. Lucas was the third of his sons to play for the Turnpike Lane under-12s, which meant that he predated the rules. "Ref! Ref! 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 Ref!" The ref was refusing to look at him now, so he kept going. "Ref! Ref! Ref! Ref!" Finally, some attention. "Ref! You're a fucking cheat!" The referee crouched down to check on the injured boy, then turned and jogged towards them with a great sense of purpose. A couple of years ago, Joseph had run into his old deputy head in the Wood Green shopping centre, and Mr. Fielding had asked him what he was up to. "Ah," said Mr. Fielding, "a portfolio. Your portfolio working. That's the future. Except not for you. It's the present for you." Joseph hadn't known there was a name for it, nor even that anyone else was thinking along the same lines. But Mr. Fielding's explanation made him feel better about what he was doing. Until that moment, he'd been worried that he'd just cobbled together a way of making a living, taken on part-time job after part-time job as a way of avoiding a full-time job. He worked more hours than anyone else he knew, but at least he'd never had to make a decision about his future, the kind where you went one way and not the other, and that was that. He did Saturdays in the butchers, 2 evenings a week coaching, and 1 supervising the Friday night games, 3 mornings at the leisure centre, the after-school care for Marina's twins with the odd bit of babysitting thrown in, and the DJing. He hadn't yet earned a penny from the DJing, the job he wanted to do most, and in a couple of months it would actually cost him money. He was going to spend 600 quid on the Ableton Live 10 suite. He'd been using a crack for a while, but it didn't work properly, and if he was ever going to get anywhere, he knew he'd have to invest. That meant not going out much, which meant not hearing what other DJs were doing, which meant not knowing whether the kind of thing he was working on now was a waste of time, because it wasn't what people wanted, or because it was already dead. Joseph knew he wouldn't regret leaving the butchers or anyone in it if the DJing worked out, and he wouldn't be bothered about the leisure centre either. He'd call in to see the twins, because he was very fond of them, and their parents. He'd always thought he'd miss the coaching the most, but it was getting harder and harder. Kids who didn't show up even if you called them 2 hours before a match. Abusive parents, opposing coaches, applauding their players when they stopped an attack with a shirt pull or a rugby tackle. And everyone, kids, parents, uncles and aunts, saw football as a way out. Any middle-aged white bloke wearing a hat was a scout from Brentford or Spurs or Barcelona, and if there was no middle-aged white bloke in a hat, it was somehow Joseph's fault. The team wasn't good enough, Joseph didn't talk up the boys in the right places. Only one player from any of the Lane teams had ever been scouted since Joseph started coaching, and Barnett let him go when he was 17. Some of the parents and grandparents who came down to watch talked about John Terry and Jermaine Defoe and Sol Campbell playing for Senrab over in Wanstead Flats. But those days were gone, Joseph thought. The Lane boys were no longer competing against kids from Wanstead or Liverpool or Dublin for places in the big teams. They were competing with kids from Senegal and Madrid, kids who didn't eat junk food and smoke weed the moment they turned 13. He had to play against the rest of the world now, and the rest of the world was both big and good at football. Someone like Lucas's dad, John, would say there were too many foreigners here, and the English kids didn't stand a chance. But Joseph didn't see why...